Welcome to the Grace in Common podcast, another episode. This is a podcast with four friends, four theologians from four different countries and three different continents, where we talk Neo-Calvinism, theology, and culture. My name is Marinus de Jong. I'm a pastor in Amsterdam, and I also teach at the Neo-Calvinism Research Institute in Utrecht. With me today is Corey Brock from the United States, who pastors at St. Columba's Free Church in Edinburgh. Also from Edinburgh, James Eglinton, who's Senior Lecturer of Reformed Theology at the University of Edinburgh, and Gray Sutanto, who is from Indonesia, but is Assistant Professor at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. So welcome to another episode. This is going to be the final episode, hopefully. You never know. We tried to close this series a couple of episodes ago, but probably this is going to be the final episode where we have a discussion based on the introduction by Gray and Corey, Neo-Calvinism, a Theological Introduction. And we've already been talking the past two episodes about the chapter on the church and the world. And we want to finish this conversation now and continue to talk a little bit about that chapter. The relationship between the church and the world is a vital element of Neo-Calvinism, also really something that's characteristic, that stands out in this tradition. There's a lot of work and development, so worth a number of episodes. So let me get our conversation going by asking a question. So you emphasize in your book, and that's also something that's emphasized by Bavinck and Kuyper themselves, is that the antithesis, like the relationship, the antithetical relationship between the church and the world is not ontological, but is ethical, right? So, and based on that, it's a little bit different, but especially the word ethical that pops up a couple of times, I wondered, what they call the cultural vocation of a Christian, and the fact that like the significance of the gospel is all of life, right? And that from the church, the believers go into the world and then fulfill the cultural mandate. Is that not just another way of saying, are we not just talking about ethics? Is this not just like a way of like undergirding a Christian ethic? And is so, and if it's not exactly, what exactly is the difference? I mean, how, for example, is that you are, that the fact you're Christian has an application for you as an artist or as a businessman, or in whatever kind of in science? It's not just another way of saying, okay, there is an ethic that applies to all of your life. And are we not just talking Christian ethics in this chapter?
The idea there is to say that the reformers came and talked about the fact that the big problem that we have as human beings is sin. And it's less about what we are as human beings trying to become something other than what we are from the perspective of the beginning of time, from creation. And it's more about the moral problem that we introduced in the beginning of history, that salvation is about reconciliation with God because of a moral problem, not because of a problem of trying to achieve some type of heightened form of existence. So the idea here is that in Roman Catholic theology, there is, at least in some streams of Roman Catholic theology, there's the thought that God made humanity in God's image and in God's likeness, and that God had to actually give us a gift from the beginning in order to make us fit for his presence, and that obedience to God would grant another gift that would mean something like being able to see God, being able to enter into God's presence even more fully, right? So this idea is tied to the beatific vision, the Visio Dei, and in the Reformation perspective, we came and said, well, actually, God made humanity in a way that was already fit for God's presence. And the real issue in the covenant of works is obedience. It's morality. And so when sin comes into the world, our problem is now an ethical stain, a moral stain, right? And so salvation is coming to fix that problem in Jesus Christ. And so that's the big idea. In other words, we're saying on the shorthand, the problem is not what we are. So being human is not the issue. somehow being human and unfit for the divine life. Instead, the issue is our disobedience. It's sin, it's justice, it's the judgment we deserve, right? And so grace restores our nature to what it should be and ought to be, holy. And grace didn't come to elevate our nature exactly into something above humanity as we were created in the image of God. That's the basic idea. I don't know if, Marinos, if that helps think about whether or not this is a chapter just about ethics. It is about ethics, but the ethical idea there is the kind of the theory that the principle of sin is a moral problem, not an ontological problem.
Yeah, no, that's a clear explanation, and I can see that. But still, I guess it also kind of, my question also comes from where I also struggled with when trying to, like, when I was working on my thesis on Schilder, is like really getting into making concrete what this whole cultural vocation and cultural mandate means in your life. Because very often I found that when you make this, like, look for example, Bavinck talks a lot about, right, about science, mm-hmm, for example. I think there it makes sense to see how a Christian view on science differs. But if you deliver mail, if that's your job, how does that work, right? And then it very quickly, mm-hmm, comes just down to, okay, just be a virtuous person. Just don't steal from the mail. Deliver it where it should be. That's just very much like ethics. It doesn't add any specifics to just like saying, okay, keep the Ten Commandments and be a virtuous person, right?
Well, I'll try to give an attempt at an answer. One of the things that I try to do in the Themelios article that just came out on the cultural mandate is to demystify the cultural mandate. I think sometimes when we talk about the cultural mandate, at least in a lot of American evangelical circles, especially in the 20th century, is to talk about the cultural mandate as a kind of add-on. Like, as a human being, there's two things you got to do, especially if you're a Christian. You got to do this thing called the cultural mandate, and you got to do this thing called the Great Commission. You got to obey both of these commissions. But as I thought about it, and the way in which Johann Bavinck, Henry Van Til talks about it, the cultural mandate to them is not some add-on command on top of what you are as a human being. The cultural mandate is just an organic unfolding of who you are as a natural creature on earth, as an image bearer. So that if you're functioning in any way on earth, like you're thinking, you are wanting to eat, you are wanting to seek shelter, for instance, you're already functioning as someone who is witnessing to the cultural mandate. And the thing about the cultural mandate is, you know, Genesis 1, 26, 28, it's tethered to the creation of the human being. It's not something that is an add-on on top of the creaturely essence of what you are as an implication of what you are, but it is just an entailment. It's a necessary entailment of just being a human being living under God's earth. So what I would say is, you know, what difference does a Christian worldview make for delivering a meal? Well, I think the difference is not, okay, the Christian worldview would make you cook better meals or something, but the Christian worldview gives you an account for why and how it is that human beings and all of their work is dignifying. Why it is that we don't want to set up a hierarchy between the scientists as being better than the one who delivers meals or something like that. That blue-collar so-called and white-collar work are equally valuable. And as humans, because we're organic creatures, just because you do one thing, another person does another thing, doesn't mean that you have to set up a hierarchy of competitions between one versus the other. So I think that demystifies the cultural mandate. I think it's just, if you're a human, you're going to set up culture one way or another. The question is, are you going to be mindful of the vertical dimension of your culture making? Does true religion animate your work? Do you see your food giving as something that is representative of who you are as an image bearer? Because we're finite. And when you're giving other people food, you are communicating their finitude as well. And you want to communicate that we're doing this because we're dependent on God, who is our food giver, you know, something like that.
So I thought Marinos, I understood Marinos as saying delivering mail instead of a meal. But I think that what you said is totally valid, Gray. Okay, and it's a different example of how to think about this. But if we stick with mail, with delivering mail, so something that I find a little bit frustrating about some of the critiques of the cultural mandate and misunderstandings of it here it's a critique that takes a lot of givenness about social orders that we live within and culture, like having a mail delivery system, as though that's just going to be there anyway. So what difference does a Christian worldview make to that? But actually, the kind of thing that you were just saying there, Gray, about how Christian worldview bolsters it, I think thinking in that kind of cultural mandate worldview sense about something like, you know, delivering mail, like being a postman or a postwoman, there's actually a whole like base layer of explanation that's needed for why we would have a mail system in a particular way. Why should people be free to communicate with one another privately as they want? Why should people care enough about one another across distances to keep in touch with one another? Why shouldn't it be the case that the government should be allowed to open your mail and intercept it and know who's saying what to whom? There are lots and lots of questions that are treated as assumptions that there's a particular like mode of free human communication that actually a well-developed mail delivery system facilitates, that are all extensions of, I think, a really deeply Christian anthropology about the value of the human being, about sphere sovereignty, about the family, about all these different spheres in terms of public life and private life. And so if you're thinking, okay, if it's like literally the task is sorting mail and putting it through people's, letterboxes in their homes or whatever, like you could do that kind of mechanically without ever questioning, why is the system here? I mean, humans haven't always done this, and it could be done very differently. Whereas a Christian worldview has that kind of explanatory power to help people see, this is why we have the mail system that we have, and why in other cultures, in the past and in the present, the state does intercept mail. It's really in the state's best interests to know what people are saying when they think it's private communication. So if you work in the mail delivery service, why should you believe in let's say in a Western context where hopefully the state isn't reading, you know, opening your envelopes and resealing them afterwards and really wants to know what you're saying to people? Why should that be the case? So why maintain that system rather than give way to some other system? Actually, the idea of Christian worldview there and cultural mandate as an explanatory base layer, like a historical explanatory base layer, is really relevant and really important. So even if the immediate task is indifferent, it's the kind of superstructure that it sets up within that does affect then how you're going to live in the world. That's a huge contribution.
Yeah, I think ancient Rome had a pretty significant mail system, I think, postal delivery system. I mean, it's also an aspect of, the right way of viewing. There are good ways to view natural law, and I think something like that is also Christianity explains why, right? But those things are products of natural virtue, common virtue as well.
So the combination of something like a Christian worldview alongside cultural mandate, which is really rooting things in, you know, Urzeit, like primordial history there, in terms of like this is a creation before a creator, means that you can hold those two things together that you just mentioned, Corey, that it's not just the kind of simplistic, you know, Christians always get there first in history. That's not the case at all. And having worldview alongside cultural mandate is actually a really good combination.
Yeah. No, this is all very helpful. And I think especially, and I find it also myself, that the whole, that there is this kind of frame of meaning around everything what you do. What I think that's what you just described, James, and that's indeed helpful also for someone who delivers mail. But it's also, it can sometimes be that it sounds all very lofty and fantastic, but it's also, it also sometimes is just really, a lot of work is just very annoying and very hard work. And then like the idea that this cultural mandate can give is like, well, can be that it's all very meaningful and you should be very joyful always doing it because you're doing God's work and it's very valuable. And it is. But it doesn't always feel that way. And there's also just like, the natural law creaturely aspect to it. And there's also sin, of course, which also affects every work we do. But it's important to acknowledge, I think. And it doesn't at all like say the cultural mandate isn't helpful, I think. But it's an important thing to stress alongside it.
Yeah. I think... Oh, go ahead, Corey.
I was just going to say, I mean, remember Keller used to always talk about how what's the way to be a Christian and a pilot? And he would just say, just land the plane. I mean, that's the most important way that you express your Christianity in flying. Land the plane, keep everybody safe, do a good job. And I mean, one of the first orders of business is that we're motivated by the glory of God when we come to Christ to do excellent, skillful work that creates beauty in some spheres where that's possible, creates artifacts that are worth something in other spheres, that keeps people safe in some spheres, that recovers people to their healthy life in other spheres, right? And all of this is because actually what Christianity does is fights against the darkness. That's our calling, right? So when we keep somebody safe, when we perform successful surgery, when we fly the plane well, motivated by the glory of God, this is the very Christian way to do things. We believe in skillful, excellent paths to pushing back sin, pushing back darkness, pushing back death and disease. And so anytime we do anything like that, we're participating in the good. And that's exactly the Christian calling. And so, you know, we talk about how the idea of Christianizing everything, you know, Bavinck uses that language, Christianize everything. And what he means by that is not make everything Christian in some type of ecclesiastical sense, right? So that art needs to be religious art or something like that. But instead, he means free it from sin, from the grip of sin. So do good by it. Take that thing and use it for good. And you've got 1 Timothy 4, very famously, that Paul says, every single thing, every single object that God has made is good and can be sanctified by prayer and thanksgiving, or by thanksgiving and by the word of God. So it's saying, I think Paul means there that every single thing that we're in that we use or produce or act into, if you will, can be made good according to its creational purposes by the word of God, meaning that God pronounced it good. If it's something that God has made and said is good, then if we act toward it or use it prayerfully and with thanksgiving, then we're using it in a sanctified, consecrated, or holy way, right? So Paul has this pretty broad doctrine, I think, of all things being made holy, consecrated. And because of Christ, that's no longer a temple, just a mere temple, sacred space ideal. That's that you can make a meal sanctified, consecrated when you sit down with your family by praying and saying, thank you to God, you made this. This is what this is for, the nourishment of our body. And now it's been consecrated and set apart. And so I think that's all we're recognizing is that grace restores nature. It restores things to their proper ends, which is thanksgiving and gratitude subjectively and to be used in the proper way objectively. So that's, I think that's what I meant by it, at least in the chapter.
That's exactly right. And so much of this is just a contemplation on being human. And Marinus, what you're trying to say is, mm-hmm. Cultural mandate does sound lofty, and we want to again demystify it as an implicate of being human. And what Corey has said there, you know, before the fall, the subjective and the objective were one thing, right? So that all of our labor was intrinsically holy because Adam was a priest, king, prophet who was working to till the garden in service of God and as a representative of God's sovereignty over that garden. So that unity between subject and object, between the religious and the laboring, was that which was split after the fall, which is, I think, a point that Schilder made in his wonderful book on the cultural mandate, Christianity and Culture, right? What was one is now split, now that the laboring that we have after the fall is not necessarily tethered to representing God in some way. And I think what Corey says too is it's not just applied to, you know, the pilot or the surgeon, but also to the janitor. Therefore, if work and the Christian view of work is to be in service of God and to now after the fall, therefore, put a stop to the darkness and sin and be a source of life-giving goodness to the world, maybe even as an agent of common grace, something like that, then, you know, the janitor is doing God's work. If the janitor is not cleaning the building, we will die. You leave the building unclean for 4 months and we will definitely get diseases there. All kinds of things as a result of the fall will end up inflicting itself upon that institution and that building and so on. So there's a way to account for the meaningfulness, again, and dignity of every sort of work because you're human. Second thing I'll say, not just the dignity of every sort of work because of humanity, is it accounts for the pluriformity of culture too. What James said about the mail and the system here, why the government shouldn't look at your mail, things like that. Absolutely, that's exactly right. And yet also when we go to another culture, and that's quite different from this culture, maybe even 50 years, 70 years down the road in the same country, will look very different because grace restores nature. And we're not against culture as such, but only against sin. There's a lack of anxiety. Like, okay, now we've got questions about AI. We've got questions about all kinds of things. And who knows what sort of questions will come out later on. The impulse is not going to be, well, AI is intrinsically bad, or this technology is intrinsically bad, or this system that's new is intrinsically bad. The question is always going to be, how does sin manifest itself here, and how can we also use the same thing for the glory of God?
So I have a question there about, to stick on the point about the meaningfulness of work, if we're thinking about it in this theological frame. So work inherently should be meaningful, but we've already mentioned also that the theology that we're dealing in also has a doctrine of sin, so that the fall happened, and that has consequences for work. So is it the case that although work in the ideal sense is inherently meaningful, that there could still be meaningless work? And it's not the case, you know, even though if we talk about work in principle as dignified and being inherently meaningful, there are also jobs that, you know, that you can get in the world that aren't things that promote human flourishing. You know, like you could become a professional assassin or a drug dealer or many, many things actually, where it's a different kind of question to thinking through something that, you know, maybe people might feel as unglamorous, like not high status work in that kind of socially prestigious sense, but it's still, you know, it's an obvious good when you just sit down and think about it. It makes the world a better place. But there is also work that people get paid for, that people devote their time to, that doesn't make the world a better place, I think. So how does this, so if we're thinking about the cultural mandate work, how should it help us to think through, let's say, like someone who does a job that's definitely not going to be there in the new creation, because it's very much work that's a product of the fall, like in terms of specific, like wrong vocation in this life. But also, what like about pastors. People who,
like pastors?
Ouch. Well, no, I was thinking of I don't know, like drug lords or something like that. but also, you know, something that you come across quite a lot nowadays in Western societies, at least, is people who have jobs where they themselves within the job really find it hard to articulate. Like, what difference would this make, especially in really bureaucratic societies? You know, I do this job, but if I didn't do it, would it actually make any difference? And, you know, there are a lot of people in Western societies who actually really struggle to work out for themselves in any immediate sense. Like, you know, like, what difference does this job actually make? I mean, there are all kinds of depressing statistics that you can look up about pointless jobs. So, let's say those two examples, the job that definitely it seems just like an obvious non-contribution to the good, but also because it's just evil, but jobs where it's just kind of like where the people who do them themselves, you know, they pick up a wage for it, it's honest work, but it also doesn't seem to contribute much to the people who do the jobs themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's the obvious category of sinful work, right? And if a person comes to Christ, then they're being called and invited either away from that job or to radically transform it in some way, shape, or form, right? So there are countless testimonies of that, like in drug lord scenarios or whatever it may be, where somebody's come to faith and they've realized that they've got to take everything they do vocationally and flip it on its head or just walk away from it, right? But then, and you know, seriously about jobs that won't make it into new creation, you know, pastors will be one of those that won't make it. And lots of good jobs, right? Like a pastor, like a lawyer, like a doctor. We don't want any of that stuff to exist in the new creation. But yeah. And then, I mean, I think James, what you're bringing up about meaningless work, trivial work, that category, there's two different issues in my mind. And I guess I'm thinking of this pastorally on the one hand. There's the situation in which you just have to deal with the individual person who is experiencing the meaningless job. And you have to ask, you know, does it make sense actually to get out of this work at this time? You know, if you do that, will it take away your opportunity to earn money and things like that? So there's the very deeply personal situation that a person might be looking at, staring at in terms of their own work and how much they dislike it because it's meaningless, right? And what you do in every individual case like that is different. But at a more theological level, I guess, from the neo-Calvinist theological perspective, I would say that, I guess my thought is that what Christianity does is it comes in and gives you a theology of vocation and gives you specific categories to hang your hat on, like that God has gifted every single person and that God has given by the Spirit joys and passions that point to the ways in which one might use those gifts. And God has given us a clear objective, which is serve the common good in some way, obey the cultural mandate by adding value, adding beauty in whatever way is possible. And like Gray was pointing out, the janitorial service does that, but there are jobs that don't do that, that don't add anything to the common good. And so I would say that if it's possible, the theology that we're advocating for would call a person to really evaluate their passions, their desires, their gifting by the Spirit, and then the possibilities they actually have out in front of them. Is it possible to pursue something else that would be helpful towards the common good? So it would oftentimes call a person and say, actually, God has given you gifts, and you can pursue those in ways that are different than what you've used them for so far. And you should maybe think about getting out of this role and pursuing something that is more serving towards common humanity in some way, shape, or form. So, but of course, we need to just say again, there are situations where people cannot do that. They cannot get out. They cannot pursue something else. But if possible, I would say that our theology would invite a person to do that, invite a person to consider that. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think you're quite right there. And it's indeed a pastoral issue, and it needs, but which can at times in it lead to need to accept the situation as it is or try to change it. And that all depends on the possibilities and what we're talking about.
So for Corey and Marinus as pastors, when you're pastoring people, particularly in relation to their work then and drawing in the theology of the cultural mandate, I guess I imagine that you probably come across a more complex real life picture than the idea that there are some jobs in you know, like late modern Western culture that are all, you know, like fantastically satisfying in every single way. And whereas there are some people whose jobs really feel like they lack meaning. I think in these kinds of Western societies, actually lots of jobs have hoops that you feel like you're jumping through just for the sake of having jumped through them because somebody says you have to. And the question of what to do with work that feels a bit pointless probably touches on a lot of parts of most people's jobs, even if it's not every part of that person's job. Do you see that a lot?
Yeah, I think, yeah, indeed. And I sometimes feel like people need to also, I mean, especially I think our generation has that a lot. We have well-paid jobs, but then they feel they don't do meaningful work. Right, that's very often they experience a lack of meaning in what they do, and then, I mean, of course, that can go to lead them to a path to find a different way to start working at an NGO or something where they have a more, and it may of course be their vocation, but I also sometimes feel that we need to not forget, especially in our context, that work is also a curse, right? I mean, that's something we haven't mentioned yet. I think, of course, it is part of the sinfulness of our reality. But in Genesis 3, right after the fall, it's very explicit that work is just, it's thorns. There is a curse element in working. And even as a pastor, mm-hmm. it's something important to realize at times. I mean, not I find my work extremely meaningful, but there's also parts of my job I just like less, but I still have to do them. And we need to expect that in our work. And especially that our generation, and I am part of that, I also only want to do meaningful stuff. I think it's something we need to recover, and it's important to stress at times.
Yeah, I was reading Francis Schaeffer's book, The Church at the End of the 20th Century, the other day, which is excellent. And at the very end of it, he was talking about how all the churches and the pastors need to stop having so many meetings. And, you know, he said committees and meetings are stopping the life of prayer, the real calling of the minister. And, you know, it's just an example of exactly that. We have meetings on top of meetings on top of meetings. And, but other great spheres of work like healthcare, right? Healthcare is one of those that's so good, so necessary, such an obvious way that God uses the instruments of human hands in the world. And yet healthcare professionals all the time are talking about the challenges of just the bureaucracy and the you know, human relation aspect of being in healthcare. And so you can see it really clearly in every sphere because work is cursed, right? As Marinus was talking about. But another thing that made me think of when y'all were talking is, I mean, this is exactly why we in the neo-Calvinist realm of theological thought want to talk about something like Christianity moving out into the world and mattering for every sphere of life, right? So, I mean, there are other options of thought about this that would suggest, you know, there's no such thing about talking in ways of making, transforming a workspace and purifying it, making something that's not holy, that's common, into something that's holy. And I have a hard time understanding that line of thought when sin has cursed everything. It's gotten into the bones of everything, including the sphere of work. Work is cursed. And, you know, we've been critiqued at times in our tradition for saying, well, you know, the Netherlands is a secular space and the neo-Calvinist movement didn't transform the Netherlands, you know, and we've talked about that here and how that's a silly argument, but it's the same line of thought, right? And the gospel can enter into a family and change the family, right? It can make a family holy. Paul tells us that really clearly, I think. And when a person at a workspace comes to faith in Christ and brings that transformation of soul into the workspace, it has real power to change all sorts of things, all sorts of things, from the bureaucracy to the dynamics, social dynamics in the workspace, to how much profit is kept by the business versus given away. I mean, at every level, it has power to change things. So I think that it's important to say, because work is cursed, that's why the gospel has such power to change everything.
Yeah, totally agree. It's quite right. And I think it's also maybe good to mention here the book by Matthew Kaming and Corey Wilson, they both are very deeply influenced by the neo-Calvinist tradition. And in that book, it's called Work and Worship. They make a good case, I think, for how to integrate more deeply, indeed, daily work and worship in the church. And that also maybe reiterates our conversation a bit back to the role of the church, which is, after all, the topic of our conversation. But yeah, I think they offer some very helpful ideas, very concrete ideas also, and show how they also like date back to earlier Christianity and to even the times of the Old Testament, where, for example, harvest is so deeply connected to the liturgy at the temple. And they mm-hmm. they try to bring our work very concretely into the liturgy. And we've been applying that in our church here in Amsterdam, some of their ideas. And that has been really meaningful for people. And it's just, I think, a very good step to help integrate those two. Because I think we also have to say that it's hard in a world where, well, this for faith and work, faith is something for something private, not something for the workspace. So I think that is a really helpful book in that sense.
If you can read Dutch as well, there's a great little book by J.H. Bavinck. I think it's called De Zegen van den Arbeid, the Blessing of Work. Right. And it gets a lot of the same ideas. It's a really helpful little book. I think that the faith and work movement gets a ton of criticism from a lot of different people. And it's connected to neo-Calvinism in lots of ways. There are some aspects of it that I think could do with a bit more neo-Calvinism to chasten some of the over-realized eschatology. But having a theology of church and world, cultural mandates, that kind of stuff, so that we can understand the consequences of Christianity for how we think about work, it's just so important. I mean, I work with undergrad students in a British context, and a lot of the time, I just feel really sad for them, or sorry for them, with the kind of cultural expectations they have about how fulfilling their work post-university needs to be. It's this extremely, it's the thing that they depend on. In terms of my work has to give me a deep sense of existential fulfillment. And you know, before they've entered the labor market full time when they finish their degrees. And I see it a lot in undergrads as they're wrapping up their degrees and starting to think about transition into work and thinking about a career. The amount of expectation placed on the work that they're going to find to give their lives like a really high degree of meaning and existential satisfaction. That's just it's a huge set of expectations to fulfill, and I think that the kind of tradition that we're talking about is really important for churches to be able to articulate. We think about where the kind of load bearing concepts for the meaning of your life get slotted into the building.
Yeah,
work hangs on some of them, but to make it the load bearing beam is really tough.
I mean, one of the things that happens for Christians is that when you become a Christian and when you start to grow into the Christian faith and the Christian life, your boss is relativized. You know, you no longer are living to please your boss. You're now working for the glory of God as a person made to work by God, right? And so now, you know, you don't exist in order to move up the ladder. You don't exist to please the people that are above you. You can actually take your primary directives in your workspace from God himself and satisfying your conscience before him. And that changes the way you work. It changes your relationship to work, and it actually restores us to a creational perspective on work, that we're made to work and God is the one who sees our work. And so it changes everything. It changes every dynamic you have, every relationship you have in the workplace, which is very, very different from the modern person and how they perceive it, as you were just discussing, James.
Yeah, sure. So when we're talking about church and world, so Corey, you just mentioned the criticism that the church and world story of neo-Calvinism in the Netherlands is a kind of disaster story. And it'd be really interesting to maybe visit that with Marinus as a Nederlander in the room, with his perspective on that. So when you mentioned that, it made me think of a conversation I had with a Dutchman when I was in the Netherlands. So I was there at a conference. I was speaking about neo-Calvinism, theology, Dutch stuff. And this gentleman came up to me afterwards and said, you know, you're not from here. You're so enthusiastic about Bavinck and Kuyper, but I don't see what we owe to them at all, because they really failed our country. And you know, the Netherlands is so secular now. It's a really terrible place to be a Christian. And you know, what on earth should we have any sense of gratitude to the neo-Calvinists for? So when he said that, I asked him three questions about his life in the Netherlands today, and then answered the same questions about my life in Scotland, you know, just an hour away by plane across the North Sea, to a country with a similar kind of, you know, long Protestant past and all that sort of stuff, Northwest Europe. So the three questions were, when he takes part in politics as a voter, does he feel that there's a political party that actually represents him on really deep foundational issues as a Christian, or does he feel not at all represented on those issues by any of the parties? And does he just have to hold his nose when he votes and choose the least worst option, knowing that the party will still kind of, even the party he votes for will look down on him in lots of ways? And he said, oh, no, not at all. The Netherlands is wonderful in that way. You've got a selection of different Christian parties, so you can even choose the one that fits you best. And yeah, it's actually a really good system. I feel very well represented in politics. And I asked them, okay, so when you go out to buy a newspaper every day, do you have a newspaper that operates out of a similar kind of world and life view that you do, that represents you again, that sort of respects that position that you're from? Or every day when you buy a newspaper, is a kind of an assault on all of your sensibilities? And he said, oh no, the Netherlands is wonderful in that regard. You have again a selection of different newspapers and from a different Christian perspectives. And then asked them third question, so when you pay your tax and it goes into the education system and you send your kid off to school, does your tax that you pay as a Christian come back to you in government-funded schools that operate out of the kind of worldview and life view that you have at home? or do you pay your tax money for your kids to be educated in a system that's really antithetically opposed to, you know, what your kids hear at church and in the home? He said, oh no, the Netherlands is wonderful in that way. You know, I'm really happy with the school that my children go to. So I pointed out to him that in Scotland, where we didn't have our own indigenous neo-Calvinism in the late 19th century, my answers to all of those questions and the experience of life as a Christian in my culture is the opposite to all of his. I would have to say no to all of the questions that he said yes to. And asked them, you know, so do you know where those things came from? And he sincerely didn't know. He just took them as givens as though they'd always been there. So I told them, well, you know, these things come about through Abraham Kuyper, Herman Bavinck. And in that regard, they've actually, like, neo-Calvinism has been really successful in your culture. It's still there in that regard. And all these things that you think of as really good things about being a Christian in your culture are directly the fruits of what Bavinck and Kuyper and others did a century ago. So when I think of the, you know, the question, did neo-Calvinism fail in Dutch culture? And we're thinking about church and world. I guess the question of success and failure is always, it depends on, like, well, what does it mean to succeed? If you didn't meet the goal that you never intended to meet, then have you failed? Not by your own standard, for example. So when I think about the question of that, of neo-Calvinism in Dutch culture, I still think that nowadays, even a century on, the experience of being a Christian in Dutch culture today is kind of unique in Western Europe, actually. The extent to which, like, the vision of society facilitates the expression of freedom to be what you are and believe what you believe. And that's not just for Christians. I mean, it works like that in pretty profound ways for other world and life views. And so, yeah, I'm just curious about that kind of critique. And when you hear that, Marinus.
Yeah, it's a very funny, you know, funny story.
The church and world story of... The church being desperate for the world in the Netherlands. What does that sound like to you?
Yeah, no, I mean, the little narrative you just did is just very true, I think. And it's indeed also true that many people have no idea that this is indeed coming from neo-Calvinism. You could also add the way the church and state are separated in our country, which is, I think, also specific for... It's comparable maybe to the United States, but also pretty specific for Europe, and this maybe not directly Kuyper, but I think the way it developed, and this is before him, but the fact that we don't pay taxes, for example, to pay pastors, which still happens in Germany, still happens in some Scandinavian countries, in the UK, of course, the state and the church are very much intertwined still, in a way that it's not here. So I think that could be added to that list. So yeah, I totally recognize, and I think another way of, like, debunking the blaming new Calvinism for it is pointing to the Roman Catholic south of the Netherlands, where secularization hit a lot harder, and the consequences of that are still visible in Dutch society right now. So that also just shows that narrative doesn't work at all.
Yeah, somebody asked that same question at ETS. You know, the questioner was very sympathetic to neo-Calvinism, but he said he keeps hearing this objection that neo-Calvinism led to the demise and secularization of the Netherlands. And so why are we supporting this, you know, secularization project, therefore, due to neo-Calvinism? And, you know, what I try to say to that person was, you know, that's a misunderstanding of the Netherlands. Actually, when you go to the Netherlands now, as you always mentioned, Marinus, there's so many pockets of conservative Christian communities. And as you noted, James, there's a sphere sovereignty model, pluralist model that actually allows for the thriving of particular Christian political parties, journalisms, and newspapers that still thrive even today due to the work of...
And schools as well.
That continue to thrive due to the work of neo-Calvinism.
And universities.
Yeah. And it's worth emphasizing that when Kuyper and Bavinck was writing initially, they were not... a dominant voice. They were not in a Christendom anymore. They were a minority voice, and Christendom had already been on the decline long before Kuyper and Bavinck went into the scene. So what Kuyper and Bavinck did was, in an already declining sort of Christendom, they were trying to preserve the Christianity that was there, and they've actually succeeded in doing that. And thankfully, Ad de Braun was there in the room, and, you know, obviously... We noticed that he was there, so we invited him to speak to the question as well. And he said, that's exactly right. Neo-Calvinism was a minority sort of position. To say that neo-Calvinism led to secularization is just not only historically wrong and anachronistic, it's also missing what the neo-Calvinist was trying to do, which is to preserve Christianity in the public square as Christians within a pluralist context. Christendom already lost way before Neo-Calvinism came to the scene for completely different reasons.
Yeah, no, it's exactly the tradition that tried to that tried to find a way to be a minority, to live in a secular context, and to still have a place in society and to kind of like survive and be meaningful as a church and also for culture. And these were exactly the debates it had with other Christians who either like often wanted to go back to a certain past and keeping like the Christendom like position within society. The voices you found in the Reformed Kerk, for example.
So Neo-Calvinism is not this, you know, entrance of secularization. Secularization already happened and Neo-Calvinism revived Christianity. That's what I would suggest.
It was definitely a revival movement,
Yes. And I think we discussed this in either season one or season two. There was one episode, Marinus, where you were talking about how in like the 1990s, maybe the late 80s, like there was a concerted effort by the Netherlands to promote a public image of itself as this like universally like ultra left-wing country. But that was a very, very much a cultivated image and never really reflected the fact that the Netherlands is also is quite a socially conservative country in lots of ways. And if you just follow Dutch politics at the moment, that's kind of obvious as well. But that foreign image is still a really powerful one. Marinus, you'll find this hilarious, but when I was about to move to Kampen of all places, which is, you know, like a very, very reformed town, and when I first moved there, some people in Scotland would say things to me, other Christians, things like, oh, wow, like, are you going to be a missionary there? Like, oh, we need to pray for you because you're going to this totally atheistic country. And like, are there Christians in the Netherlands? Like, are there like thriving churches there that people actually go to? Like, yes. And then you move to Kampen, which is, you know, where our church had like 550 plus members. And that's not a large church in that kind of a setting, although that would instantly be one of the large churches in Scotland. The kind of expectations that people, even Reformed Christians in Scotland, had, where they were just utterly unaware of Christianity in the Netherlands today, and the fact that the Dutch church scene is like astronomically larger than the Scottish church scene, that public image is still a really strong one.
It was amazingly successful.
Like, that needs to be shaken up a bit.
It was an amazingly successful campaign, apparently. And it's I also all the time when I'm in the United States. People have this image is reflected, and it's just not true very often, or at least hugely exaggerated. And indeed, also in the current political landscape, we can just definitely see it's not true, or changing towards a more conservative posture. Not necessarily Christian, though, unfortunately, but conservative, yes.
Yeah. The other aspect of this is that we should have never looked out at the world and develop our Christian moral theology based on what's happening in the culture at the time, right? We derive our moral theology and our marching orders, our ethical marching orders, from scripture, right? And so, you know, if things aren't going well, we just still do the same stuff we've always done. And if things are going great, we do the same stuff we've always done. You know, the early church did it the same way. And I think that's one of the issues here, is that the idea that, you know, the Neo-Calvinist theological concepts don't work because something became secularized or something wasn't transformed all that well. It's just a consequentialist argument. And, you know, we're not looking out and deriving our moral theology from what happens on this particular street or this particular building or this city or this, you know, government. Instead, we're actually trying to read the Bible and develop it from there, right? And so I think that's one of the big things that I've noticed in these arguments is wanting to look out objectively at the world and write an ethical, create an ethical mandate based on that. And I think you see this, you know, underneath ideas like the Benedict option and things like that. It's a consequentialist ethic instead of just saying, well, I just think we're kind of, you've got to hold steady. You've got to just do what the Bible's told us to do for all the centuries.
Yeah, I think Glenn Scrivener and Andrew Wilson's new podcast on post-Christianity addresses the same question, and they've argued for the same thing, that we're going to continue doing what we're doing even in a post-secular context because we're called to be the church. Another thing to say too, in addition to what you just said, Corey, is that we shouldn't form our judgments about another culture from what we see in the social media and the news feeds, right? Because I think that's really what's happening. You know, what Marinus was saying about the Netherlands, these preconceptions about the Netherlands, really remind me with the parallels of people's criticisms of, let's say, New York City or of Jakarta or of Indonesia being, you know, the largest Muslim country in the world or something like that. You know, when people talk about New York, like, oh, it's so secular, blah, blah, blah. But as we mentioned in the last episode too, they're great churches preaching the gospel to a lot of people, a lot of young people, 600, you know, we talked about Exilic Church, 600 Asian Americans listening to sermons based on Voss and Klein and the Abrahamic Covenants when I was there. I mean, I was just really amazed by it. And there's so many other thriving churches in different parts of New York City and so many faith and work movements, so many mercy ministries going on motivated by the gospel there that I would argue New York is a very Christian city compared to a lot of other even suburban areas in the United States. Just so much Christian activity going on. And it reminds me of, you know, when people hear that I'm from Indonesia, like, oh, are you persecuted there? You know, are you free to have churches there? Things like that. And I'm just like, yeah, we are, you know. And there's articles studying Indonesia being such a great case of pluralism where, you know, for instance, in 2016, The Atlantic wrote an article on why ISIS couldn't recruit fighters from Indonesia. Because Islam is seen as one option among many. Islam is not talked about poorly, but Muslims are getting along with Christians, Buddhists, Catholics, and so on in Indonesia that ISIS people are having a hard time radicalizing these folks because they don't feel disenfranchised and they're getting along with other people. They're free to worship and so on. So Indonesia is a very moderate Islamic country, despite the fact that in terms of population, yes, it is the largest Muslim country, for instance. So just don't form your judgments on the basis of hearsay. There is, you know, I believe in affect theory. You just have to be there to feel the vibe, so to speak, before you should form those judgments. And when I was in Kampen, and indeed I was there, my wife, you know, she was so surprised that we can't go anywhere on Sunday because everything was closed because everybody was following the Sabbath and we're in the Netherlands. So
go Kampen.
Yeah, and it's not just social media. It's also the Christians who do that, I think. I mean, if you, for example, have... If from an American perspective, have like missionaries going to Europe, that narrative can be greatly enhanced. I think something can be worse among Christians. And that's exactly for, so we have this organization, Open Doors, here in the Netherlands, which does like raises money for persecuted Christians. I think they can also, but the picture they draw of Indonesia is very much as you just said, and I learned from you that it's quite different in Indonesia compared to the picture.
Right.
Not that there's not persecution, never ever, in Indonesia, no. But it's just like, what are you emphasizing? Christians sometimes can also, they just love this narrative of having a different country where Christians have a great difficulty, and then we can come over and help. Like this is a narrative we love.
That's exactly right. You know, follow the money as much as anything else, right? How do you get fundraising in New York depicted as the most secular country, and therefore send your people there, send your money there? How do you fund missionaries to Indonesia? Well, you got to depict it as bad as possible. If you depict Indonesia as, well, it's pretty bad, but also sometimes pretty good,
yeah,
then you're not going to motivate a lot of people to send people there. Though we, you know, we're thankful for people to be sent there, but it's the messaging. It's I actually met somebody who came to Indonesia and was really disappointed that he had the freedom to worship there. Because he's like, I came, I was ready to suffer. But you're worshiping in a mall and the food is good. And I don't understand, you know. It depends. If you're going to Jakarta, of course, what I'm saying is more accurate. But if you're going to another part, let's say Aceh, then of course you're going to get more persecution. But it's just a lot of islands, for instance. So visit the country yourself.
Yeah, so true. Hey, let's raise another question. We almost have an end, but there was one thing I wanted to ask you guys. So my thesis, my PhD thesis on Schilder was about the relationship between the church and the world. And the title I chose was The Church is the Means, the World is the End. And about my defense, there were some people asking questions about it. Understandably, it was a little bit provocative, the title, and in some ways it's, I think, not true. But also reading your chapter, I was like, yeah, this kind of fits. This kind of fits what you say also. So what do you think, Gray? Is it a good summary of your chapter as well, or would you not sign off that?
It depends what you mean. I'm scared to use the word, but it's kind of a dialectical relationship, isn't it? I mean, the church is a means in the sense of when you're gathered, you are rescattered again, you're discipling people. I mean, what we're talking about in terms of a theology of vocation, for instance. That's how I think as shepherds, as pastors, we are supposed to help people navigate through that sort of work. And that's the scattering moment, right? And so the church is a means to disciple the people, to disciple the nations, to form good citizens to so that their desires are reoriented and so that they could find meaningful work and so on. Yet at the same time, if the church is the means of the world, what are we shaping the world to be? Well, we're shaping the world to be the church, right? To be a God-glorifying, to the ends of the earth community who sees the earth as a great good, and we're only against it, not against culture. And yet at the same time, the culture is good precisely because we're beholding God, because we're walking with God, because it is God's presence that makes all the difference, right? As Moses said in Exodus 33. So the church is the means for the world to become the church. Maybe we could do it that way.
Yeah, no, I agree that you need to add some layers. And also you could wonder, maybe it applies to the church as institution more than the church as organism. And of course, Schilder emphasizes institution. So for him, it works perfectly.
Yeah.
Also in the sense that the church is going to, in that sense, as institution, as Kuiper calls it, as scaffolding, is going to end when the God recreates the world. But the church as organism is not. I mean, there's still going to be the people of God, worshiping God. But yeah, so I do agree, and I think this layer also helps it. But it does, I think, make the point of Neo-Calvinism nicely that really what happens in the church needs not stay in the church and is not like an end in itself, but it points beyond itself also.
Amen. That's exactly right.
So thank you for being with us this episode, where we have been discussing the final chapter of Corian Gray's book on the church and the world relationship. Also been talking about the relationship between work and worship, between faith and work. So please leave a review in your podcast app that helps other listeners find our podcast, tell your friends about it. And also we'd love to hear back from you. So any feedback, questions, or episode suggestions, more than welcome. You can find us on social media, Twitter especially, or send an email to graceincommonpodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you want to help us financially, you can find a link in the show notes to Donor Box to make a donation. Thank you very much for listening. This is Grace in Common.